Teams everywhere are dealing with a serious problem, a productivity problem. Don't worry, HubSpot's customer platform can help. No more time-consuming tasks, no more chasing down prospect info, no more one system for this, another for that. HubSpot helps you find leads, reach prospects, and deliver the insights to convert them to customers, all in one place. Make your productivity problem no problem at all. Visit HubSpot.com to learn how they can help you grow better. And welcome to another Bite, where we rewatch the most innovative and intriguing pitches from Shark Tank. I'm Jory, and I'm joined today by Ariel.
Hi, how's everyone been? Get it? Bean. Coffee.
Bean.
Starting off with some puns.
Love this. Keep this rolling. So today's a bit of a special episode because, you know, we've kicked John to the curb. Sorry, John. And we've replaced him with a special guest. Today, we've got Margaret Nyamumbo on the line. And Margaret is the founder of Kahawa 1893. And that is a Kenyan direct coffee company that was featured on season 14 of Shark Tank. We've got a lot to dive into today. It's a tall order indeed. But first, thanks for joining us, Margaret.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So the first thing that I wanted to kind of dig into was really you and your entrepreneurial journey way before you made it to Shark Tank. So part of your Shark Tank segment was you mentioned that you came from Kenya and you grew up on a coffee farm. Is that right?
Yes, I did. So I grew up on my grandfather's coffee farm in Kenya, and I essentially was running around the coffee farms, like eating the berries. So coffee is almost like a berry. What we consume is the seed that's inside of it, but it's actually similar to a cherry. Oh. So we grew up sort of running around the farm and, you know, picking the berries and eating them. In fact, we didn't actually drink coffee in Kenya. We exported all the coffee. We drank tea instead. Ooh, so it was interesting for me when I moved to the US for college. And then I found that the coffee drinking culture in the US was amazing. It was like you're drinking coffee in the morning instead of tea. And so I really got into the culture.
So was coffee something that you always knew that you wanted to pursue in your career? Or was it that something that came later as you were sort of like reflecting on your journey and where you wanted to take your life?
Not at all. The opposite. Okay. So growing up, one of the things that is very sort of well known in coffee is the inequity. So farmers don't really make enough money from growing coffee. So it's considered a poverty crop.
Oh, wow.
It's something that you do because you fell into it. So the idea for me was, you know, my parents wanted me to go get an education and get a desk job. So if I was running away from coffee, I didn't think that I'd ever go back to it. And so it was very surprising for them that I went back, and they were very resistant at first because I came here, did my undergrad, got my MBA from Harvard, and I was working on Wall Street at the time. And so it was a big shock for them that I would leave my office job to go do coffee, which, you know, they considered it not a great thing to do. So when I was working in banking, I used to cover consumer companies, and I really got interested in building something from scratch. And when I thought about what I wanted to build something that had an impact. And so growing up, one of the things I noticed was that a lot of the labor in coffee, about 90% of it, is actually performed by women on the farm. But you don't see women in the rest of the supply chain. So you don't see women-owned coffee companies. They're not that common. Coffee looks very male-dominated. In fact, white male-dominated in general. So you don't see that same diversity on the coffee side that you see on the farm side. And because of that, we know the wages are not that high because the work is being done by women. So it's being undervalued. So I wanted to build a brand that focused around women's empowerment and really making sure that the women got compensated. And so one of the things that I did was I introduced a tipping idea. So on the back of our bags, there's a QR code that you can scan to tip the farmers. And that idea actually came because what I observed growing up was that the women, even though they didn't own land, they were the ones that still ran households. They still had to run the household. They still had to make money. And the way that they financed their households was essentially borrowing among themselves. So they came together in groups and did something called table banking. They sat around a table, got a big pot, they put all their money into that pot and gave to one person. Wow. So because they were not banked, they found a way to bank themselves. And so when I started, the easiest, most direct, impactful way was, how can we add more money into that pot? And that's where the tipping idea came from.
Which is such an amazing idea to ensure not only that your brand has like a means to continue to support its mission without having to like sacrifice scale.
Sure.
Was the tipping idea, was that influenced at all by like the American culture? Tipping is such a huge part of coffee shops and baristas in the US. How much of that would you say is impacted by that versus this is something that you kind of always had that intention set out for?
It was 100% influenced by coming to the US and kind of seeing how tipping worked. And I realized, you know, consumers, because of how the market is set up, we want to pay more for coffee, right? And if there was a way for us to circumvent the market dynamics and actually directly support the farmers, we could do it. And so the tipping model was 100% inspired by seeing how tipping worked here.
Mm-hmm. So when you had this first idea of like, you know, this is something I want to pursue as an entrepreneur, once you were set on really turning that idea into a business, were there anything that you had to keep in mind or any pitfalls that you learned along the way that you'd encourage other entrepreneurs to potentially avoid as they're thinking about doing the same?
Actually, when I started the company, I wasn't thinking of it the way that you'd think about, oh, I'm going to build this business to be big and do something. I was thinking of it mm-hmm. as something I wanted to do on the side, something I wanted to do to transition into something else. So for me, it felt like a project and it allowed me to really explore the brand sort of from just pure passion. I wasn't super worried about margins, profitability. Who am I going to sell it to? How am I going to make a living? It was a passion project.
Fair.
That's something I would encourage people to do, especially if you're starting out something that's brand related, because it takes a while to build a brand. It's something you have to build brick by brick and really build trust. My first customer came from my friend's company. So I told my friends, I want to do demos. I want to do tastings. Tell me, you know, if you know a place I can do it. So my friend said, oh, you can come to my office and I'll like organize for you to do a tasting at my office. And then I met other entrepreneurs and they were doing markets. So we went to markets and at the markets, the really cool thing about doing it that way versus doing something in a lab and then coming out to launch this like really nice brand that you've kind of, that's very visual and aesthetic, is because you learn a lot from customers. So I was new to the coffee industry and people's preferences and being in the market, having people taste the coffee and tell me how they liked it revealed a lot of preferences that I literally had no idea. I used to drink myself like sometimes instant coffee at home. So like, I didn't really know how people drank their coffee. So it was like market research out in the wild, not a survey, just someone tasting the coffee and telling you how they think about it. So I think that's like very useful in terms of building brick by brick, really building a community, starting an Instagram and you have like 5 followers and then 100 and then 1,000. Yeah. It's really slow at the beginning.
Yeah, you got to start somewhere. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, brick by brick. So I really enjoyed that process. Mm-hmm. And another thing that I did was when I launched, I didn't have enough volume to buy bags and packaging. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I don't know if you guys remember the millennial time where everything was in jars.
Yes, the mason jar
craze. And I was like, oh my God, I just put the coffee in mason jars. It looks cooler, right?
Tie a ribbon on it, call it a day.
That was really just because I didn't have enough, you know, volume yet to buy things in bulk. And I was like, actually, I'm going to use that constraint as a feature.
I think you're such an important person to look up to for women of color, but also just like business owners that might represent, you know, more minority groups. And I was curious if you had any advice based on some of the reflections from your journey and what you've learned for other entrepreneurs and founders and how you found success.
Yeah. One of the biggest things that happened to me at the beginning was I got lucky, but this is something I would encourage other entrepreneurs to do is I found a mentor. So it was someone that had been in the industry for a lot of years. I'd actually been like part of opening like the first couple of stores of Starbucks. So he like knew the industry really well. And in fact, they encouraged me to start a brand because they said, actually, there isn't anyone like you. There's no voice like you. So usually in coffee, a lot of the brand is kind of third party. So a lot of brands are speaking on behalf of farmers, right? On behalf of producers. So this was like the first time that, you know, I could just speak directly, both as someone who had their background in producing and really talk about the coffee directly and really tell our stories without them being edited.
Sure.
And at the time, Specialty Coffee was very snobby. Mm-hmm. So it felt very like privileged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there was a bit of pretentiousness there, right? Mm-hmm. And so there was a language, you had to have a certain, like, there was a certain way to do it. You had to have this expensive tools to do it. So there was benefit in having someone that could be more kind of approachable. Sure. And really speak directly about the process. You need to find like a mentor, someone that's already done it, mm-hmm. and ask them for pitfalls, because you're going to make the same mistakes
yeah.
mm-hmm. that everyone makes. So you want to make sure like you save time and money, especially. And also just as a minority founder, I didn't limit myself to networking just within other minority entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And because our industry is predominantly white male, mm-hmm. I specifically was open to seeking allies. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to make sure that I could get support yep. from people in the industry that had the power. If you want to understand or like penetrate an industry, you want to make sure that you are talking to the power brokers mm-hmm. as opposed to being on the periphery.
Sure.
You know, I think I'm delusional too, so that helps. You have to be delusional.
We all are.
Okay.
A little bit.
We're all a little delulu. It's
you
fine.
Have to be to go in and build a business.
Yeah. So I think not being afraid to ask for help and network. And what I found was interesting is that people in the industry also were concerned and had observed the inequities, but they felt helpless.
Yeah.
So I think my appearance mm-hmm. on the scene provided for them like an actionable point to actually like have an impact and help and give yeah. back. Mm-hmm. They felt like, oh my God, like we want to help sure. you, because we do see the same inequities, but we just haven't been able to help in a meaningful way.
So Margaret, I'm curious to know, was there a defining moment for you when you realize that, hey, I'm really passionate about this. I don't want to just have this be like a passion project.
Yeah. After founding the brand, after a little bit, I moved to the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And what happened there was we ended up supplying the coffee to some of the tech offices in the Bay Area. So think like Facebook, Twitter.
Smart. Yeah.
Yep. That's how you get into the startup
yeah, yeah,
scene.
Yeah.
The coffee drinkers.
Yeah. That was validating, right? To be able to supply coffee to corporates. But then what happened was the pandemic happened mm-hmm. and that whole business went away. Mm-hmm. And then we were down to ground zero.
Yeah.
And then that's when I was about to be, okay, like brush my resume to find a job.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And then we got another lucky break. And that's what entrepreneurship is about. It's a lot of like a series of like lucky breaks mm-hmm. as you're yeah. about to close shop. A break happens and you're like, oh my God, we're still alive. And so we got a lucky break where we got into Trader Joe's mm-hmm. and we became the first branded coffee they brought into their store. We became the first Black woman-owned coffee brand to be nationally distributed.
Which is huge.
I didn't even realize how big this was, but I remember browsing through Facebook and then like seeing news stories about it. Mm-hmm. Like the first time I'd ever seen anything like
You're
that.
You're like, it's real.
Yeah.
It's like, wait, that's me. That's my brand.
But yeah, so that was like the big break. So once we got into Trader Joe's, like it gave mm-hmm. us sort of like that boost that we needed to really keep going.
So I'm very curious, at what point was Shark Tank brought onto your radar and you decided to ultimately go for pitching to the sharks?
It was something I never considered. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because I don't like pitching in public. Terrified of all that. Like I only do it out of necessity for like grades or something. So it's not something I like wanted. Like I watched the show and I was like, oh my God, like those people must be very, mm-hmm. and I'm coming from Kenya and our culture is very reserved, and especially for women, we're very reserved. Mm-hmm. So for me, being in front of like such a big audience and like really being able to go toe to toe with very famous people,
yeah.
I thought that was terrifying. Mm-hmm. So I never considered it. I don't even think I'd make it there. But a friend of mine had ended up doing it the year before.
Okay.
And then casually mentioned it to me, you should do Shark Tank. Yeah, I was like, oh, you should do it. And I was like, I don't know. Like, it just seems like not a good fit for me. But I just filled out like a form online and I wasn't even sure whether it was a scam or not. And then I got a call back. To be honest, if I knew how hard the process is, I would have probably be even more terrified. So this was like ignorance is bliss.
Fair. And it worked out. So there you go.
It's a good strategy for the Shark Tank. Yeah.
They do a really good job of giving you bite-sized, pun intended, kind of tasks. So you never feel overwhelmed.
That's
so
good.
They're like, do this week. Okay, next week, here's something else. And then here's something else. They never kind of dump mm-hmm. everything on you on day one. So it feels very like, just like you're walking slowly. Before you know it, you're like at the podium.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I was never thinking about the airing. I was always thinking about, oh, this is a useful process actually for an entrepreneur, because they make you go through a whole almost fundraising process. They help you understand your business better. They help you understand like how to pitch it better. Mm-hmm. So to me, this was free coaching.
Yeah.
When you think about
it's
it.
It's a good way of looking at it. <though. laughs>
That's a good point. Yeah.
It's a forcing mechanism to get your stuff together. They force you to think about your margins. They force you to think about just your business in a way that you just never really did.
Yeah.
I really thought that it was a positive experience, whether you make it to airing or not. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the episode ended up being amazing in terms of like the discussion, the negotiation, and I ended up having a shack that I wanted with a good deal. The episode also went viral.
Yeah, in Kenya, right?
In my community here, it went viral in Kenya. I got calls from like the press in Kenya. I did some interviews. Even the president's office gave me a call. I got, it was like such a big cultural moment in my community. Mm-hmm. So it was like, I became like famous. It was kind of weird. It was just a positive experience in general.
So you walked away with a Shark Tank deal. You walked away with a partnership with Emma. I have to ask, what has that looked like post Shark Tank? What's been the biggest surprise or even the biggest learning with working with Emma so far?
It's been such a positive experience. Emma's great. I honestly didn't know how much hands-on the Sharks world could be. Mm-hmm. You know, just different investors have different levels of involvement.
Sure.
But part of the reason I picked her was I kind of had expertise and specific genius in branding and strategy. Mm-hmm. So just to see that, you know, be actualized has been great.
That's awesome. Has there been any like major lessons that you've learned from her so far?
I think in terms of lessons that I've learned is that you have to do the work, that there is no magic. So I think sometimes when people see like successful businesses, they think there's a formula that works. But I think what I'm learning from Emma and from other sort of people in industry is that you still have to do the work.
Yeah.
You still have to do the groundwork. It's still a lot of building. It's still a lot of hard work. It's still a lot of talent that goes into success. Mm-hmm. I was tempted at the beginning when the brand was smaller to chase after like this thing will transform the business. Like, and then you realize actually it's not. Like you do need to build brick by brick. There's no magic formula to anything. Everything is built over time.
As you were building brick by brick, but also as you think about scale, I have a marketing question. So
yes,
specifically for a specialty coffee brand, but then also just like your experience as an entrepreneur, what have been some marketing channels that you've leaned into that have been really successful for you and your brand? Like, has it been user-generated content? Has it been email marketing? What's your strategy been in terms of like the marketing side of things?
Our DTC has grown due to Shark Tank, but our business is still primarily wholesale, so selling to consumers. So our marketing looks quite a bit different from our regular brand because we focus a lot of our marketing at the point of sale. So we're doing a lot of our marketing sort of on the shelf, which is where customers are making that decision.
Cool.
And then on the DTC side, there's sort of two types of marketing that people think about. There's like brand marketing, which is sort of top of funnel, which is making people aware of the product exists, but you're not selling them a specific product. And then there's performance marketing, which is sort of the Facebook ads or Google ads where you're making a specific offer. You can track the ROI on that spend, right? So for us at this point, we've been focused more on the brand marketing side, which is sort of top of funnel, increasing brand awareness. And that's because a lot of our business is in wholesale. Attribution is trickier, right? We don't know if someone saw the brand, someone's going to like watch this podcast and go and buy it at Trader Joe's. We don't know, right? Because of the nature of our product and the nature of coffee, we think it's very powerful to tell the brand story. My only advice is, again, to focus as an entrepreneur. Like, I wouldn't be torn in too many directions. Pick one channel and do it really well, right? And that's where sometimes entrepreneurship can feel like formal because like you think people have success in other channels and then you're tempted to go to those channels even though they might not be the best fit for you.
Right.
It's a discipline thing, thinking about, okay, what is actually really good for me and like, what do I want to do it? So for us, it's been brand marketing is kind of what we found to be most powerful for us. We're really focused on that.
That's awesome.
Which makes sense because you all are in a very competitive space in a very competitive category when it comes to coffee and specialty coffee. And is there anything else from like a retail perspective or other ways to like drive that foot traffic as you're building that awareness?
Yeah. For the retailers that we're in, you know, one of the ways that we do that is they call them shelf talkers. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever been to a store and they'll have like a story, like Whole Foods does it now where they'll have the story of the founder next to the product. And that's kind of like a way of bringing your social media like on the shelf. So someone's, you know, knowing a bit more, like putting a face to the product, right? And being able to see something that they would see on your website, right? So that's, I think, really powerful. And then I think, you know, retailers have all sorts of like programs like on their newsletters that you can participate in to make sure that customers are aware that the product is in the store. So there's like different strategies that you can use to market to a retail customer. And then once they're in the store, draw attention to your product. Mm-hmm. One of the things we invested in, obviously, was packaging.
Yep.
We wanted our packaging to stand out on the shelf. And that's paid off because a lot of our first time tries are people are like, oh, this looks cool. Let me try it. And then it tastes great. Now it's my coffee. Mm-hmm. If you have a physical product, don't underestimate aesthetics. Mm-hmm. They matter.
That makes sense. So as we're wrapping up, I have to ask, what's new and upcoming from Kohala 1893 that we should keep an eye out for in 2024?
I'm so excited for 2024. Mm-hmm. We're going to be releasing new products.
Ooh,
I can't say anything about them yet, but they're going to be new ways of enjoying the products. So I'm excited about that.
Keep an eye out.
New cool partnerships with household names.
Nice.
So I'm excited about that.
Cool.
But I think it's going to be like a year that we really like stretch our arms and play around with all the fun that you can have with coffee that's never been had before. So I'm pretty excited about that.
I have to ask also, you mentioned not really drinking coffee before coming to the US. How do you prepare your coffee now? And like, do you drink coffee now or is it still very much the tea side of things?
So with coffee, what I realized was like knowing how to brew it is the most important. So I'll give you like three quick tips.
Ooh, yes, please.
So I kind of brew different ways, but like today I used a French press. I love how simple it is. You can't mess it wrong. So the way I brew it, I grind it fresh. So I have a grinder. And when you're grinding it, you have to grind it for the brew method. So for French press, you want to grind it a little bit coarse. And then for other methods, you want it to be a little bit finer, right? And so you want to grind it fresh, like you get the best product that way. And then the second most important thing, and this is something I didn't realize until like I went into coffee, was the temperature of the water is the most important. Because I used to think all coffee was bitter, but it's because the water is too hot. So the temperature of the water determines which components are extracted from the coffee. And when the water is too hot, it extracts a lot of the bitter components.
Oh, like tea.
That makes sense. Wow.
Yeah. So that's really transformative. And also like that's why the grind size matters too. So if it's too fine, it's going to over-extract. There's a science to extraction. And so grind size and water temperature are like the two things that are always interacting with each other. And then the third one is like the roast level. So there's like light, medium, dark. It's like if you're doing your steak rare, medium rare, dark. And it's a preference thing, right? So if you like your steak well done, like that's your preference. So you just need to know that that's the roast level that you want. If you like it rare and like blood dripping, then you want your coffee super light.
That's a good analogy. Yeah, it's like,
so it's a preference thing. So knowing, so I came to realize that I liked my coffees lighter and a lot of the coffees get roasted very dark. And that's actually like commercial because like when coffee's low quality, you would want to burn it anyway. So no one can tell it was bad. So that was like a cost saving thing that then like became like a taste preference. Because when you drink something for a long time, you kind of start to like it. So that's what happened. Like over a long time, coffee was being burnt because it was like lower quality. And then we just got used to like, this is how coffee tastes. It's burnt and bitter. Like that's coffee. But that's not coffee.
Just bad
that's
coffee.
Just like a commercial way of like making use of coffee that's like bad quality, right? To make more profit. And so that's why lighter coffee, like specialty coffee was really good about lighter coffees because we were able to showcase actually when coffee is like high quality, you don't need to burn it. It's about knowing like the right kind of ingredients, the quality, how to roast them, how to brew them. And then like after that, I'm just like tea, like I don't know you, but you know, sometimes in the winter, I know you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Margaret, for this.
That was amazing and so insightful. And we're so excited to see what comes out next year.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait.
Stay on our radar. Super, super excited and hopefully like good things.
Yeah. Your story is so important because it's like we do have entrepreneurs that are just starting and don't know what they don't know. So hearing from people that have been successful is always awesome.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me.
Today's episode was brought to you by the magnanimous Matthew Brown. Editing comes from Robert Hartwig and support from Melanie Romero. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, or wherever you subscribe to the greatest podcasts ever. That does it for me. See you in the tank next week for another bite. I want to take a break to tell you about a podcast coming to the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. It's called The Next Wave, AI and the Future of Technology. It's hosted by Matt Wolf and Nathan Lands. AI technology is transforming the way we do business, and the media landscape is currently fragmented. The Next Wave is leading the pack on AI technology and how you can apply it to growing your business. Matt and Nathan are leading AI creators and your guiding light in the AI and technology frontier. Listen to The Next Wave wherever you get your podcasts.